The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing any attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy, and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In carrying out the work of the Theosophical Movement, we meet twice a week. This Sunday morning meeting, of course, the doors open at 10:30. The meeting is from 11 to 12. It's usually a talk or a panel or a lecture. Our title for this morning, under the overwhelming subject, Tools for Spiritual Evolution. Our title this morning is The Power of Impersonal Thought. And next Sunday, The Knowledge of Nature's Aim and Purpose. On Wednesday evenings, the doors open at 5:15. We have a reference library with not a huge number of books, but a good quality of books. And there's always someone there to assist you in following up on references or particular books you want to look at. We would remind any newcomers that you can find the Straight Line Theosophical Literature on the web. So you don't need to come into the library. It's a good idea, but you don't need to. And that's the Phoenix ULT website. You can check at the book table for the, is it called the URL? Oh, good for me. The library is open until 7:15, and then at 7:30, our Wednesday evening study class begins and runs till 8:30. We are studying William Q. Judge's Ocean of Theosophy, which really is a synthesis of the major ideas in the Secret Doctrine. That in itself is incredible. The work done here or at any lodge anywhere in the world is done on a voluntary basis, in time, in money, in service. If you want to make a donation because you think, as obviously we do, that these ideas should be kept alive and in front of the world, you can make a donation at the book table, or there's a small box on the side of the room. Now we will have a talk on our subject of impersonal thought, and then afterwards there'll be ample time for question and discussion.
The title states, "The Power of Impersonal Thought." Doesn't all thought have power? Most of us do not deliberately choose our thoughts. Instead, we let our thoughts gravitate to whatever is happening around us. But consider that one of the most powerful laws in the universe is the law of attraction, and that the physical reality in which we live is a sort of holographic mirror, designed to become the exact reflection of the thoughts that we have. When you think of it like this, we have more power than we could possibly imagine. Let's learn to have thoughts that direct this power in the right direction. Thoughts of me, my, and mine are identifying with personal directed thinking and will eventually create a feeling of separation, loneliness, and estrangement. It is at the very core of suffering. Theosophy would tell us that this thinking is in direct conflict with the one great teaching of this wisdom religion, that of universal brotherhood. Theosophy views universal brotherhood not merely as a nice ideal or a worthy goal, but rather views it as a fundamental fact of nature. With the scientific knowledge available to us today, it is easy to recognize that within any ecosystem, all parts work together holistically, to promote the health of the whole. When one part is removed or begins to function out of balance, the entire ecosystem falters and suffers, and disharmony of one becomes the disharmony of all. We can see that this easily in one climatic zone. We can see it equally for the earth as a whole. When we expand our vision, we can see that the same law holds true for the solar system, for the galaxy, and for the universe as a whole. Theosophy would say that this holds true throughout every crevice and corner of reality, from the physical to the spiritual, including all things in one vast, unimaginable, boundless all, the essential oneness of which is the foundation of the truth of brotherhood. Brotherhood is thus not a choice. It is not something we can decide to be true or not. It is truth. Our choice lies only in whether or not to live it in harmony or disharmony with this fundamental law. When we carry this law of unity to its ultimate conclusion, we see that no thing is truly separate from any other. No being is truly cut off from other beings, and every action, however seamlessly small, affects all in its own way. In discussing universal brotherhood, HPB walks us through this truth in the key to theosophy. She states, all men have spiritually and physically the same origin, which is the fundamental teaching of theosophy. She also says, as mankind is essentially of one and the same essence, and that essence is one, infinite, and eternal, whether we call it God or nature, nothing, therefore, can affect one nation or one man without affecting all other nations and all other men. This is as certain as it is obvious that a stone thrown into a pond will sooner or later set in motion every single drop of water. When we consider this idea, we are led to agree in full with Blavatsky's later statement, also in the key, that where she says, by wronging one man, we wrong not only ourselves, but the whole of humanity in the long run. It has been said that philosophies do nothing, only people do. Yet that may not be quite true if we take into consideration the statement attributed to Plato that ideas rule the world. So putting ideas out there is actually doing something. Not since Plato had anyone brought forth a comprehensive expression of what we often call the ancient wisdom tradition or the perennial philosophy that takes into consideration the spiritual, psychic, and the physical sides of life, as well as science, philosophy, and religion, and shows how they are all interwoven and interblended at every point. Desire is the cause of all suffering, said the Buddha. Selfishness is the great curse of humanity, say his followers. Few thinkers would argue with this. In fact, most would readily agree, yet they are not able to bring about the needed changes in the world. They cannot bring about or initiate higher, nobler, and purer attitudes and actions in their fellow men and women because they don't approach or attempt to deal with the world's problems from the only basis which can bring about true, lasting, positive change and transformation, and that is from a spiritual basis. Am I my brother's keeper? Moaned Cain of Old Testament fame, or actually infamy, to the supposed his Lord God, after having brutally murdered his brother Abel. No, we are not our brother's keeper. We are our brother. There is no separation in the universe. The illusion of separateness prevails here on the physical plane only because we do not put our personal self and thoughts in their proper place, which is that of unflinching and unwavering subservient to the spiritual being within. Although the personal self is nothing more than a karmic product, we must treat all personal selves with love, respect, care, and compassion. If we would welcome and appreciate patience and consideration from others towards the undeniable defects of our own personalities, we should be the first to give the same. Be more charitable for others than for yourself, and more severe on yourself than on others, were some words of advice given by HPB to Mr. Judge, who subsequently recommended it to all. Indeed, if everyone were to follow such advice, almost all human conflict would swiftly disappear. In the Dhammapada, Buddha tells us that better than a man who conquers in battle 1,000 men times 1,000 is the man who conquers himself. He indeed is the mightiest of warriors. Each of us in our own quiet hour must determine when we must act in behalf of a particular cause in the world, when our conscience demands that we do something to ameliorate a particular suffering or stand up for a blatant injustice affecting others or against destructive actions affecting the environment and thus future generations. Theosophy proposes that there is a purpose to life and that all sentient beings, visible and invisible, are an expression of this purpose as it unfolds like a flower through a triple evolutionary scheme, spiritual, psychic, and physical, the spiritual giving impulse to the psychic and physical. It further teaches that all is life, and there is no dead or blind matter, that life is directed from within outward. Every outer action has an intelligent inner impulse that consciousness at some level is always at work, and that reincarnation and karma provide the field and the means for this ongoing dance to take place. The core principles of theosophy, if absorbed and understood, lead one to the realization that knowledge is responsibility. When this happens, a kind of alchemical process of transformation takes place within, where the question naturally arises, how can I best act within my circumstances on behalf of the whole? In closing, we are reminded of a true story when Ralph Waldo Emerson, the American transcendentalist, visited Thoreau in a local jail. In 1846, Henry David Thoreau was jailed for not paying his poll tax. He did this out of conscience. He did not want his taxes in any way supporting the deplorable institution of slavery. The story goes that when Emerson went to visit him in jail, he asked Thoreau, "What are you doing in here?" And Thoreau's response, "The question is, what are you doing out there?" The topic, once again, the power of impersonal thought.
Remembering that our umbrella topic is tools for spiritual evolution, we have had a wonderful presentation that gave us ideas about impersonal thoughts and a sort of, oh, I love words, especially when they run away, a point of achievement of some of this idea. So we thought it would be best to focus on what are tools as individuals that we can use, because we're all full of wonderful ideas. We read well, we talk with each other, we come to classes and experience these ideas of the ancient wisdom, what was known to all great thinkers, and yet we go home and we're back in our personal way of thinking and behaving, unless something comes up, and then we may sort of snap to. So what do you think are some of the tools we could use on a daily basis to make it that we couldn't avoid these ideas? Yes?
Not being attached to what you're doing, that is going to come out for me, for the better. No, just not be attached to it, just do it.
Not be attached to the doing, just do it. Well, that's that's a discipline that one has to have to really honor these ideas. But what about the one who's starting out? How do I start out with some tools that will make me be impersonal some of the time? Yes.
I think written reminders.
Written reminders, when, yes.
But you say words run away. Mm-hmm. And to put some of these thoughts where you see it, you know, several places throughout the house through your day.
Excellent.
You jog.
Yes, it's a remedy. It really is. Just as you would take a particular medicine because you had a particular condition. Yes, make a poster of some idea, or put it on a little card and carry it with you. We are leaving out for you a handout. On one side, it's the statements of the Buddha about thought, and on the other, it's the power of thought from our theosophical texts. And I know that if I had this on a card and I looked at it once a day, I would snap into a realization how far off I am. The Buddha said, one tree can make 1,000 matches, but one match can burn 1,000 trees. One negative thought can burn all positive thoughts. There was another hand.
To live in the day and not to worry about what has transpired in the past, or not to project any negativity into the future, not to cross any bridges before you come to them.
Start building.
Not to destroy any bridges before you come to them.
Again, that's a discipline. And those are beautiful and wonderful things and would make a wonderful card to carry around. But first, we have to get there. Yes?
One of the best impersonal thoughts that we can have is to remind ourselves that we are the observers, to be aware of our thinking, just as we are aware of the senses, the impressions we have, to learn to watch ourselves. Not necessarily a discipline, but just observe the way we think at the beginning.
It is the best way to start, of course. We are the observer. We are the thinker in evolution. I mean, Theosophy teaches that we are spiritual beings, mind beings. And that's just words in a way. I love when you have so many thoughts you can't remember where you got them all. Mr. Judge in The Ocean of Theosophy, we are all thinkers and we all assume that we have minds. But of what does the mind consist? What we call our mind is not, in reality, mind at all. The mind itself is the power to think. And there, right there, is the clue to our power. At all times, we are minds that are active. We don't realize we're observing. We think we're generating all of this. But we're observing and acting mostly from impulse, with some reminders, some things written down to reflect back on the fact, impersonal, I want to be impersonal. And these ideas will help me. Yes?
Well, one tool that anyone could choose that is appropriate to him or her would be a symbol that would mean impersonality to the individual. But really, we can't think of a better symbol that is always there, that if we just think of it, whenever we're outside, if we glance at the sun, we can't think of a better reminder of the impersonal light and life that it shines, no matter who, what, when, or why. Everybody gets the same sun. So maybe we could think of that.
Oh, that's excellent. The entire solar system, the entire universe, visible and invisible, is supported by that. Yes?
Well, from our childhood, the term all for one for all. And as children, we think we did a better job of that until we got older. Now, we can ask ourselves, all for one for all. And our topic this morning approaches that theme. Mm-hmm. But as children, we understood it. But by this time, it doesn't seem to work too well.
But what is it that happened to us from childhood on? It's an important thing about this subject. Yes.
Well, we got caught up in all the materialism. Life happened.
Life doesn't happen. We make it happen.
Advertising happened. So there's so many distractions that occur. So when we, as was talked thinking about when we're here and we're talking to people. It's wonderful, but you walk out that door and we're bombarded. I mean, the news happens immediately.
Well, it always did, but we didn't know it so much before.
Exactly. We know it immediately.
Right.
So there are just so many distractions, and the original question, what can we do practically, is turn off the TV.
But that does not affect our thinking. It keeps things from banging in, but it doesn't affect our thinking. Yes.
There's advertising, there's all the different news stations. We think it does impact our thinking.
Oh, yes, it impacts it. It doesn't change it. That's the point. Who and what can change the way we think? Yes.
Only we can.
Oh, that's right. Only the individual.
But it takes discipline. It takes a practice. It takes an outlook on life.
We are going to get to that, I promise you.
Well, I'm here already. I wanted to.
Well, good for you, but a little humility wouldn't hurt.
For all of us.
The fact is, we cannot have a discipline that will override the disciplines we have from education, from our parents, from a religion that we might have been brought up in, until we can step around that or see it for what it is. We can't have a discipline. So we need these tools. There's an article called Lonely Musings in Magazine Theosophy, Volume 9, and it recommends that we ask ourselves three questions. And then it gives a little sample of what we might think. It's a little advanced, but we can get the idea. What am I? I am a fragment of the all-pervading deity entombed in the flesh, working through slow and painful progress towards liberation and reunion. Now, if we start with what am I, we have to consider as well the three fundamentals of theosophy. And the first one is that all life is one, visible, invisible. There is only one source of life, and it's an absolute principle without alteration. And it's in the worst human you've ever imagined in your life as much as it's within the Buddha. It is all one and the same. The difference is the use of our powers. Why do I work? To reach the home from which I started, the pure state of unconditioned being, the richer for having fulfilled my mission. Now, philosophy often avoids this issue, but the philosophy of theosophy teaches that we, as thinkers, as spiritual mind beings, entered the human forms on this planet to experience and grow in our own awareness of reality, the spiritual reality, but also to impress and elevate the life behind us, the lower kingdoms, to get them ready to the point in the next period of evolution. Thinkers will be using their forms, and you will then have that connection that really says the lower becomes the higher, because the thinker initiates that lower intelligence and makes it a part of itself. So that is our mission. How do I work? By striving neither good nor evil fortune to disturb the serenity of my soul, by detachment from earthly desires, by doing good to all creatures, by keeping the ultimate goal in view, extending this sympathy and pity for all that endures life, and by using every earthly act that has to be performed as an act of sacrifice and devotion to the deity within, which is the non-attachment, and which is why there are all these devotional books because they do prompt us to become more impersonal, but they are also a kind of explanation. We are different from each other in the use of our powers and therefore of our present ability. Some need intellectual pushing, digestion. Some need the devotional books. So we try both. We try to find what will help us keep the line that we want to keep, the impersonal thoughts. Yes?
So, whereas all thought has power for the realization of the ideas we hold, impersonal thought seems to have the additional benefit of elevating our awareness and consciousness, unlike any other kind of thought. If we want to expand our minds, we have to think in harmony with that larger plane of awareness.
And in doing so, I mean, we all know if we're in a bad mood, and we know when we're in a bad mood, everyone around us feels it and knows it. We even did that as children. We might have gone in the front door and then turned right around and went to our room because we knew there was something going on and we didn't want to hear it. If the negative affects and influences silently, what do we think the purely spiritual does? People don't even know it, but you may find yourself attracted to a certain individual, and you think it's maybe because they remind you of someone else, or maybe it's the tone of what they're saying. You don't know what it is. It is an attraction to spiritual ideas. So we all have those we look up to from the past, from the present. You had your hand up before in the very back. No? Okay. And then you.
Well, could that be, we talk about the vibrations and how different vibrations, mm-hmm. you know, attract each other. Well, we think in regards to the impersonal thoughts that those vibrations might be at a different type of level than if they're personal thoughts, and maybe that's what is the attraction, is that...
Well, yes, we think you're right, but there's two things. There's the vibration, and then there's the reality under it, because it stimulates us. It is our real nature that we're tasting and touching. So yes, it is vibrational, but it is more than that, and we don't know how to put it into words. Maybe somebody does. Yes?
I think lower vibration, like me thinking, is fear, your survival, fear-based. And that's the anxiety, that's the separation, fear for self or children or clan or political uh-huh. party. And to be in faith, like, you know, the sun comes up every day, we are all, you know, blessed, we are all
right.
alive, we are all, so, to, you know, to get into nature and, you know, out of ourselves, I think is another way to experience existing in faith rather than the fear that we must
right.
conquer something to survive.
We also think, though, we all know the vibration from certain music can absolutely put us in a very special place. Whether it's Mozart or Beethoven, Bach, it is something like a devotional book. You had your hand up.
Well, we're raised in a family, hopefully, you know, with parents and grandparents who teach us certain things to develop our character, to be loving, compassionate people. And in the best of situations, inevitably, children will tend to develop early on certain defense mechanisms that are necessary to them among their brothers and sisters or in the first grade. And these defense mechanisms have their place at the time. Sometimes we hold on to those defense mechanisms for a lot longer mm-hmm. than they were ever serving us for. So, and that is all a function, very definitely, of the lower personality.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we should make efforts to compare, you know, these ideas and the truth of what we're told we really are in the devotional books to what have I really been thinking.
Right.
And then find out, is there something...
And how do I associate with these family members who seem to be difficult? We recall something written by... We think her name is Mary Ann Williamson. And someone wrote into her and said, you know, there are people in my family I can't stand, so I'm going to spend Christmas with friends. And we're sure the person expected that's a good idea. And she wrote back, that is ridiculous. Your task is to spend the time with those family members as though they were friends. It's you who has to change in your attitude towards them. So unless we have a firm place to stand, though, how do we look at those tendencies of ourselves? Because usually people beat themselves up or give up the task very quickly. But if you have a basic understanding of the ancient wisdom, which belongs to every culture, every religion, it's all there as the basis of one and the same thing. How do we get to where we can handle impersonal thoughts and changing our own selfish responsiveness? It's by studying those ideas first. In the back.
Before it was mentioned that it's very helpful to remind ourselves that as minds, we are thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other very powerful tools we have is to remind ourselves that we are always choosers.
Mm-hmm.
And so in every situation, we can make a choice how we think, how we feel, how we speak, and how we act.
Mm-hmm.
And we also can choose our motive for those things.
Thought, will, feeling, memory, imagination. Only in the human kingdom where the thinker is present do we find the ability to will and choose on the basis of our own motive and thinking and feeling. But going back a minute, and we think it was you that brought the point up, we have to observe ourselves, realize how we will and choose like an echo. We sometimes don't even think about it, we just respond. And we know that's not a good response or a helpful response. Or we begin to think about it and we start to wish or will that we would behave differently and we fall right back into the trap. The point is not to criticize ourselves, but to be the scientific observer. You are watching a creature that you have created, your own lower personal nature. It isn't you, it is yours. So until you watch it and catalog some of its tendencies, you cannot be a good alterer of that behavior. Yes?
If that's the case, what did HBB mean when she said to Judge, be harder on yourself and charitable to others?
That's a very good point.
How can we harm ourselves if we're not very critical? What does that mean?
Well, first, be harder on yourself. That's the line from the Bible as well. I can't think how it starts. It's about the mote and the beam that we see all the faults in others, and we don't even look at any of our own. So we would start there, be harder on yourself. And if you see a fault in someone else, take the philosophical hint that what bothers you is when somebody exposes a fault that you have. In other words, that relative that I can't get along with, who's always boastful and noisy, it bothers me because I am boastful and noisy, even if I don't recognize it in myself. So life is like a mirror showing us what we are like. The Buddha said that too. Where did it go? The thought manifests as the word. The word manifests as the deed. The deed develops into habit, and habit hardens into character. So watch the thoughts and its ways with care, and let it spring from love born out of concern for all beings. So from going from observing ourselves, then watching ourselves in action, then we stand in a place where we understand I am one with all of life, and I will be harder on me and more helpful to those around me. Yes?
Well, along the process of doing that, to realize I'm a perceiver and begin to turn that perception, a tool that we need is concentration and one-pointedness. If we allow that lower monkey mind just to, you know, jump around through all these different ideas and random stream of consciousness, we don't have the tool to stand firmly as soul and to watch.
Okay, let's just discuss for a minute and then we'll get to you. How do we develop concentration? Yes.
Maybe this is wouldn't do for everybody, but I think to journal and to write our own stories and our own thoughts, when you put it on the paper, it's you can gain in objectivity. So I don't know if it...
And no, that is. And memory as well, because you are recording what you have just been through, and that sort of doubles it. Anything we write, we remember more. So that's a step. What are some other ones? Yes?
Well, we're talking about concentration and tools for impersonal thought. You know, what was said earlier, those powers of the mind, thought, will, feeling, imagination, and...
Memory.
Get them all headed in the same direction. So when we say one-pointedness, that's not just like thinking of one thing, but like, what resource do I have to direct toward whatever's important in the moment?
Right.
No matter what it is.
Mr. Judge had a wonderful, some wonderful advice for gaining either concentration or the discipline to stick with something for a little while. And it was, oh, you don't want to study? Well, then just set a clock or a timer and only study for 10 minutes. Stop when the 10 minutes are up. Well, if you keep doing that faithfully, you will not need the timer anymore, and you will get mad at the timer, get out of my way, I'm concentrating. Because we are thinkers. Once we really devote our mind to something, whether it's, well, it's, I think, the best example in the world of the genius of the female mind, and that's getting everything on the table at Thanksgiving, all hot. 15 different things, all requiring different lengths of time to cook. That's brilliant. How do we do that? Because we watched others, because we learned by doing. It's we concentrate then on what we know. But we have to make the decision, I want to know. If we make that decision, our own will, which is spiritual force, will help us do that. We can do it by taking a certain text, and we know we don't understand it. It's way too difficult for us. And we read through it once, and we journal. We take some notes of what we discovered. And then we do it again the next day, and the next day. And pretty soon, our mind is responsive to that, and we can concentrate on it. And then we have this wonderful moment where we say, and it's really funny, we say, I see. And what we're talking about is the mind. We see. We have become part of what we're studying for that moment. And that develops concentration. But you can do it with poetry. Take a poem you love and memorize two lines of it every day. It's makes you kind of, I don't know, open to beauty in the world, which is important. Yes?
Another simple, maybe it's not easy, but a simple of practicing concentration is being aware of the present.
Mm-hmm.
To keep our minds on now, what we're doing now. The immediate effect of that will lessen our fear and regret for the past and future, but it'll also make us more aware of what our current duty is. And that is a great protection and guide to perform one's duty in the moment.
Right. And if we don't have a duty at the moment and we practice what you just said, we'll learn a pretty powerful lesson about ourselves. If we can last on one subject for more than 2 minutes, we're well on the road to concentration. Most of us can't do that. We're skipping, jumping to the past, to the future, and all full of fears and concerns, as was said. So it is a wonderful thing to do. Yes?
In some of the literature, we read this statement, stand aside in the coming battle, let the warrior fight in thee.
Mm-hmm.
And the last comment, theosophy seems to be telling us.
Seems to be
about
what?
Ourselves.
Telling us.
Stand aside in the coming battle and let the warrior. Well, who is the warrior has always been a problem sometimes.
Ah, what did the Buddha say? Look within, thou art Buddha. The warrior is the spiritual self, that divine essence that is the true nature of all of us. We stand between the highest we can imagine and the lowest we are working through. But we are none of those things. We are all one with the absolute principle. And it certainly doesn't seem like it, but it's a temporary condition. We're here in this physical lower nature for maybe 100 years. And then the philosophy teaches that the after-death state before reincarnating can last 1,000 to 1,500 years for most people. But people that are in a hurry to understand their spiritual nature will come back more quickly. But the whole thing is temporary and fashioned by us. The things we leave undone will wait for us. The things we have accomplished, we will keep. The awkwardness and requires a great deal of study on reincarnation and karma, because for all we know, everyone in this room is light years ahead of where they believe they are at the moment, because obstacles that we created stand in our way, and until we fix them, life will not let us go on. Because if it did, we would get to a very high point with a big fault. Mr. Judge uses an example, and he uses it to remind us, don't judge others by what you see. And he speaks of a miser, someone who just nothing but money. They just want money, money, money. And the others look down on such a person. How pathetic. And Mr. Judge says, such an individual may have just that to conquer, and then they will be a Buddha. So don't judge anyone, even yourself, although be hard on yourself. Judge your present actions. Don't judge the problems you have, because you may have made a pledge somewhere that said, I want a very difficult time because I want to get stronger. I'm weak and I see it. So you can't judge. You can only respond from the highest place that you can achieve because of your impersonal thinking and the disciplines that you've been doing along the way. You can make a radical change, but it may not show in full till a future life. Yes?
So we have to start by changing the way we think.
Yes.
So thinking that I am the witness to the everyday. ever-changing world in which I'm immersed in, and that we are responsible for every thought, word, and deed.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Judge says it's a contest of smiles, if we only knew, because here we are, these powerful spiritual beings. And look at us, it's like we're got our hands and feet tied, and yet there's no end to our powers. So we should smile and go, okay, this lesson may not be a pleasant one, but it is a lesson. You wanted to...
Well, it's just that this philosophy keeps on pushing it in our face that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature, mm-hmm. and that all of nature is intelligent, and how we've been treating it, it's having a reaction, or how we treat it will have a reaction. So everything is a conscious and alive, so it's really in this material world in which we live, we have to let our mind expand to consider that we're septenary beings, and that and every part of our, every principle is a different state of consciousness. And that it says in one of the chapters in the ocean, these seven constituents are in co-adjunition but not in consubstantiality. And we need to figure out what that means, because they're not of the same, they're not
of the same substance, but they form one unit. But you know, we all know that, and we don't take enough time to think about the mystery. I mean, just look at your hand. There's skin and bones and muscles and nails and funny spots that just show up, you know? Think about it. How does it all work together as a hand? What kind of genius does it take to do that? Well, that's true of everything about us. It is all different kinds of substances from the lower kingdoms that are in us, pass through us, that are impressed by us. And how else would we learn? All of that is not the problem. All of that is tools. It's how we use the tools. We use the tools to make money. We use the tools to get ahead of somebody else. We use the tools to get even with somebody who did something to us. We are ridiculous. But we, at any point, can stop and turn around and change. Yes?
One of the impersonal ideas we're told that we can keep with us when we walk out the doors and face the problem.
And we have to walk out the doors, yes.
Is to have that mantra that the struggle is not with persons,
but with ideas. And the struggle is not with forms, it's with forces. We can keep making those for ourselves as we observe more and more. The struggle is with my perception, my reaction. I own that. Nobody can force me to do anything. It was Epictetus, the Stoic philosopher, when by mistake, we think, he was sold into slavery. And his owner said, "I want you to agree with me on this." And Epictetus said, "No, I have the right to accept and reject. That's my only right." And he said, if you don't agree with me, I'm going to break your leg." And Epictetus said, "What a shame, you'll harm your servant." And he broke his leg. So we own perception and reaction, choice, will, desire. And we have to start from the point where we realize, I am a selfish, greedy person. I have grown up with it, everyone around me. I mean, even in school, weren't we in competition with one another? Even if it was subtle, didn't we compare what you get on your exam? We were always trying to prove our value. Well, our value is our spiritual nature, and it can't be proven except as we express it through life, as we treat each other with brotherhood, with love and kindness. So it isn't a difficult thing. It's difficult to realize, or as Mr. Judge said, it's difficult to want to do, because everything we've been taught tells us to want the other. You had your hand.
We considered what was said a few minutes ago about we reincarnate, the immortal soul will come back and pick up where it left off because it left things undone. So if impersonal thought, obviously it would seem, is more grounded in the higher nature, the immortal nature, and personal thought is in the lower. Nevertheless, if we're picking up stuff that was undone when we left off, then it's not just a given that as we continue, we become more impersonal. Depending on how we accept or reject these ideas, we may get more and more grounded in the false ideas.
Well, because we weren't on the subject of after death, we didn't mention a very important point. While we leave behind a sort of package for ourselves of things that we did that we shouldn't have done, or things that we never got around to doing, we take with us every high, noble, impersonal thought, action, even desire, where we didn't act on it, and we build it into our nature. And when we come back to face those problems, we have the assimilation and digestion of all of that in our nature. It's not fully active, it's more like an aroma of spirituality. But we don't lose it, we keep it. We're very close to being out of time. We wanted to end with this from Transactions, a book by HPB. Apparently, the whole basis of occultism lies in this, that there is latent within every man a power which can give him true knowledge, a power of perception of truth, which enables him to deal firsthand with universals, if he will be strictly logical and face the facts. Thus, we can proceed from universals to particulars by this innate spiritual force which is in every man. And man in this case means human, which means thinker, not gender. We invite you to come next Sunday for further information on the tools for spiritual development, spiritual evolution, and that this is available to be picked up. Meeting is adjourned.